Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peek, MUFON field investigator in the state of Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia. And today's episode is sponsored by All Things UFO Facebook group and Gypsy Days clothing line, which will be coming real soon. Today we have author, researcher, investigator, and UFO historian David Marler to come on and talk about his work of over 32 plus years of being in the field of ufology. He's investigated for MUFON, done lectures at UFO conferences, and starred on many, many documentaries on the UFO subject. So we'll be breaking down all of his research, so strap on them seatbelts, we're going for a ride. All right, welcome to episode 42 of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peek, MUFON field investigator in the state of Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia. And today's episode is sponsored by All Things UFO Facebook group and Gypsy Days clothing line. Today we're here with our very special guests. We have UFO historian, author, investigator, and researcher, David Marler. David, welcome to the show.
Jesse, it's great to be here with you. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to get you on for some time now, and I'm happy it's finally happened. Been someone that I've looked up to in the field since I started on my quest in the ufology, and it's great to actually have this conversation with you today.
Absolutely.
So you've been in this field for 32 plus years. You joined MUFON in 1990. What was your inspiration for joining and actually getting into the field of investigations?
Well, it's funny looking back on it, Jesse. My interest really in UFOs was at a very early age. I remember 5 years old hearing the term UFO. It was 1973, and my father was interested in a series of sightings in Piedmont, Missouri back then. And so that was kind of my introduction to the term UFO. But I had a growing interest growing up in the 1970s. There were a lot of documentaries and a lot of pulp magazines on the subject. But it really wasn't until 1990 that there was a local newspaper article in Southern Illinois, and it was talking about a local MUFON group, which I'd never heard of MUFON before. And I was just shocked and amazed that there's actually an organization of people that seriously look at UFOs. And so I was rather naive at the time, but quickly met with the assistant state director, who is still a lifelong friend of mine and mentor. And he got me into the organization, like yourself and many others that are listening to this. Started as a field investigator trainee, field investigator, worked my way up to state section director, and ultimately state director, and did that for about 7 or 8 years, being the Illinois state director for MUFON. And then during the course of that time, obviously doing investigations, I was developing and building a small library, which has now kind of grown to epic proportions. And I'm now the archivist and a board member of CUFOS, and have the NICAP CUFOS case file collection here, along with Dr. J. Allen Hynek's original Project Blue Book materials, in addition to many, many other historical items. And I'm happy to not only use it for lectures and my own research purposes, but I share it with a growing number of UFO colleagues and researchers that come here to do historical research.
Yeah, I've seen you on many different TV shows and documentaries of people coming over to your house, big time researchers, and actually doing some hard evidence work with you. It's absolutely amazing that you have something like that, that people can come and actually take advantage of something like that here in the United States. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, when I first started, I was rather naive. I thought, Jesse, you know, I need to learn about the UFO subject more if I'm going to be an investigator beyond just what the MUFON training entailed.
Exactly.
And I went to several local libraries asking, you know, can I see your UFO books? And they either didn't have any or maybe had one or two, but that was the extent of it. And so at a very, you know, early age in this field, I just decided, well, I guess if I want a library, I'm going to have to build my own.
Well, you definitely did an amazing job. And I definitely found myself in the library when I first got started as well. I found that was the best way to educate myself on what I was going to be getting involved with before actually jumping feet first in this field, which I think a lot of people should take that route when they first get into it to understand it better.
I agree.
So that's completely great. And I heard you're also working with, is it Philip Mantle that's actually sending you some information as well?
Yes, Philip, to my surprise, reached out. Well, we had ongoing dialogue for a number of years now, but one day he just laid a bombshell on me that, you know, I need to make plans to preserve my collection of case files. And of course, Philip's been doing this for, I think, between 40 and 50 years, something like that. And he said, I've got a huge collection of case files, historical materials, et cetera. And one day he just told me, he goes, I'm going to send it out to you. Now, he's not just doing that because I'm a nice guy, because I have a historical collection, although I think he wants to add to the efforts that I'm doing here. But the rationale or the reason, the main reason that he decided to do that is I have an incredible working relationship with the University of New Mexico here in Albuquerque. And I approached them probably 7-8 years ago now and didn't know anyone there, but I wanted to preserve the material that I had at that time. And unfortunately, Jesse, many of these historic collections from both prominent as well as lesser known UFO researchers over the years have wound up in trash dumpsters and landfills. And we've lost a lot of data, a lot of material, a lot of hard work and research. And I didn't want that to happen to my collection because I've had some aging researchers that gave me their collection. So people like Lou Farish, who is a well-known historian on the subject, hosted the Ozark Mountain UFO Conference for many years in Arkansas. He, when he was dying, told his friend that I want Dave to have all of my material because he's doing good historical research. So included in my collection are elements from his library, as well as elements from other researchers, such as Antonio Huneas. I have his case file collection. Dr. Leon Davidson, going back to the 1950s, 60s, his personal correspondence collection is in this. Lieutenant Carmen Morano, who was one of the last staff members of Project Blue Book, in addition to Hynek's Blue Book material, I have that as well. And so, you know, putting all of that together, it's really exciting from a research standpoint because you can cross-reference a lot of this material and much of it goes together. And before I forget, something that I've been working on the last year and a half extensively, my friend and colleague Rod Dyke up in Seattle, Washington, who did the UFO news clipping service for many, many years, in addition to Lou Farish, when he realized I had the historic NICAP case files, sent over 200 reel-to-reel and cassette recordings going back as early as 1957.
Wow!
With regard to interviews with witnesses, rare TV, radio broadcasts that were recorded. And I digitized, I think now, as of last week, 265 audio recordings chronicling the early history of the phenomenon. And this is unique. This hardly ever happens. He sent the NICAP audio recordings because I had the NICAP case files here. Not only was I able to digitize the audio recordings and digitally remaster them, but we were able to reunite the audio recording, and I was able to match those up with the original NICAP case files. So now we have all of that data together. And as I mentioned earlier about cross-referencing the data, now you can listen to the witness interviews, and here is the actual handwritten report going back to, you know, as early as 1957, 1958.
That's extremely rare. Like you said, I mean, most of that stuff has been thrown out in the trash or not kept properly, so it gets deteriorated over time. And to have that all in one place like that, where someone can come in and take advantage of that, that's absolutely astonishing. It's great.
Well, it is. And, you know, it's only one data set. Admittedly, you know, MUFON has an extensive case file collection. So being able to share data like that, if MUFON is seeing a trend in the data, they can reach out and then I can look to see, you know, this pattern that you're reporting. Let me see if that is reflected in the case files from the 1950s, the 1960s, or Jesse, to your point, when I received the UK UFO case files from Philip Mantle, is it reflected in those case files? So we all have pieces of the puzzle, as I like to put it. And the more that we can collaborate and share data, I think that's the only way we're ever going to get close to finding any answers or even some semblance of answers to this UFO mystery.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a big key is the collaboration in the field, and people need to start working more together in this field.
Yes.
To get the best out of it. If we want disclosure, I think, you know, like you said, everyone putting all of our stuff in one place to be able to research, the cross-examination is the best possible aspect of that, having it all in one place.
Well, and I'll be doing a new lecture series across the country this year, and my lecture is going to be focusing on triangular UFO reports that predate stealth technology. And I went through systematically over the course of the last year. You know, people always say, well, what did you do during COVID? Well, I buried myself in historical UFO files during COVID. I went through, for the first time, I might add, Barry Greenwood, my friend and colleague, said, you know, you're the first one to ever do that with those files. I went, and by the way, just to conceptualize this for the audience, the historic NICAP CUFOS case file collection is 15 four and five drawer file cabinets filled front to back. So just to give you an idea of the scale that I'm talking about with regard to these files, but I went through starting in 1947 all the way up to 1977 and looked for any credible documented triangular UFO reports to really bolster what I wrote in my book back in 2013, but also my goal is not only to talk about these reports, I want to share them with audiences. I want them to see the files that I am used to sitting here seeing. And in some cases, again, going back to the audio recordings, they're going to hear the witness testimony because some of the audio recordings that I digitized, no surprise, were interviews with witnesses of triangles. And in particular, and as I'm sitting here now saying it, I'm realizing this, for you and your audience from Pennsylvania. One is from, I believe, Pleasantville, Pennsylvania, 1964.
Okay.
And I have the audio recording, which I was able to digitize and remaster and, you know, clean up a little bit. And the witness is describing a triangle, and I have his NICAP report. So you have the sketch, and then you have his verbal testimony. But what's unique about this, and again, no surprise for any veteran UFO researchers out there, this is one of those cases that I've talked about before over the years, where it's a triangle, but the witness is describing, the odd thing about it was the triangle was flying with the flat side as the leading edge.
Really?
And he describes that and even draws that in his sketch, where it's not the point of the triangle that's the leading edge, as we would think with, say, you know, any type of delta wing aircraft, for example. It's the flat side that was the leading edge as it was moving.
I haven't heard that too much.
Yes, it's one of those characteristics I outline in my book. There's a number of other historical cases, as well as contemporary reports, where they describe that. And when you think of a triangular object, not only with length and width, but thickness, I always, you know, jokingly refer to it as being as aerodynamic as a brick if it's moving like that.
Right. Yep. It doesn't break the air as good and doesn't fly as good without turbulence.
But it's so gratifying to find these historical reports that are describing in detail what we're getting today. Again, I know some people think that these triangles are new or that they might be military, and I can see that maybe some of them could be. I certainly don't know what state-of-the-art technology is as far as compartmentalized classified projects and aerospace. But when you see these accounts that echo the modern-day accounts going back to the 50s and 60s, it's really a head-scratcher.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to get your opinion on that since you are big into the triangular craft. Do you know, like, you have a percentage of what you think might be like the TR-3B compared to a normal triangular aircraft that really is an ET craft or not from here?
It's really hard to put percentages on that. It's a great question, Jesse. What I look for are what I call the anomalous characteristics, such as that the blunt end forward movement, as I call it, or the ability for these things to seemingly join together and then divide. In the NICAP case files, which I'll be sharing with audiences this year, there's a beautiful sketch, and it shows a series of three episodes as this sighting was playing out. This was a case from Florida, again, mid-60s, and the witness was hunting with his hunting dog, and he just again, for the UFO investigators out there, that I'm sure they've heard this before from witnesses, the witness didn't see or hear anything, but he just had this instinctive nature just to look up.
Yes.
And when he looked up, he saw not a triangle. He saw a diamond-shaped object that was a dark pinkish hue with a black line right down the width of it, down the middle. Essentially, it looked like two triangles connected together at the base. He then described in the NICAP report and sketched it the second phase of the sighting, where he literally saw the diamond separate into two triangles. In other words, they pulled away from each other and there were two triangles. And then the third stage, before the objects moved away and disappeared, he sketched two triangles sitting side by side facing the same direction. What's interesting is in this report, he indicated that when he first saw the diamond, it was a dull pinkish gray color. But he noted a color change when the objects separated and when they moved side by side with one another. He said it went from a dark pinkish gray color to a bright luminescent red color. And I say it's interesting because when we get details like that in some of these reports, I think it gives us a little glimmer or insight into the energy that's being utilized or displaced when these objects are moving or conducting some of these maneuvers in midair. And so maybe that gives us some indicator of energy that's being displayed when it's making this maneuver. Another one, before I forget, is one from Albany, Georgia, 1953, from Project Blue Book files. And this one involved a pilot flying at night. He, in the Project Blue Book report, described seeing this very circular light in the sky. He stated that it didn't appear to be a planet or a star in the sense that it scintillated. It had a very sharply defined circular edge to it. And he's flying and he keeps noticing this. And then he notices it's alternating white, orange, white, orange. And so he decides, well, I'll increase altitude. If the object changes perspective, then it must be something in the atmosphere. If it doesn't change perspective, it must be a planet or a star. Well, he, in the Blue Book report, he states he increases altitude. And within a matter of seconds to a minute or so, the light that was above him was now below his aircraft. So he knew it wasn't a star or a planet. He then decides to descend and try to close on the object to get a better look. One of the most dramatic and bizarre reports is contained in this Project Blue Book file. The pilot states as he was closing on the light changed into an equilateral red triangle. And then he states within a second or two after that, the triangle separated into two triangles, one directly above the other, and then they disappeared.
Now, what do you think? What do you think the theory is behind having these craft all combined into one and come apart into little pieces like this? Are they multiple different craft that become one, or are they just little scout ships? Do you have a theory behind this?
I really don't. The only thing I can come to is, again, it's a head scratcher. I just think that there's a lot more about physics that we don't know when we see these types of behaviors. You know, it boggles the mind. I hate to speculate,
right?
But when you see that in Air Force Project Blue Book files, and I know sometimes people relegate Project Blue Book and say, well, it was all just disinformation. We have to remember that the reports that Blue Book had were legitimate reports. I always tell people, right, read the report, just ignore the section that says conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
formulate your own conclusion, but the information by pilots especially is interesting. And one final note on that case, it's also bizarre and unique in the sense that it's one of the rare triangle cases where we apparently had radar confirmation of the UFO, because the Air Force investigators noted that the Albany, Georgia airport had a primary radar target at the exact altitude and location when the pilot had his sighting.
Wow, that's great. That's great confirmation to have that to coincide with the case.
Yeah, I always say radar visual are some of the most compelling because, you know, we can say, well, eyewitness testimony is questionable. I don't go to the extent that some of the skeptics do, where they say basically you can't take eyewitness testimony at any value. I disagree with that, especially if you have multiple witnesses all describing the same thing. But to your point, when you have radar confirmation, now you have objective measures that are bolstering the subjective interpretation of what the witness is seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. So have you ever, is there a way that we can kind of differentiate a normal triangle from a TR3B? Are there certain characteristics of our TR3B that are different?
Well, let me back up real quick, because I don't use the term TR3B. I reference military vehicles, but I am a skeptic when it comes to the quote unquote TR3B, because that's kind of become an urban myth within the UFO field that we know these things exist. Truth be told, if you look at the history of that story, it quite literally goes back to one man, Mr. Edgar Fouché, who unfortunately is no longer with us. He passed away, I believe, in 2017. He claims that he worked at Area 51. He claims that we developed this triangular aircraft. I in absence of evidence to back that story up, I just summarily can't believe it. So I tend to shy away from the term TR-3B. However, I don't deny that some of these could be military, not to say that it lends any credence to the Edgar Fouché narrative.
Right. See, that's exactly why I wanted to have you on and ask these questions.
Answer. And again, some people get very defensive about that. They firmly believe in Edgar Fouché and his claims. And, you know, Jesse, I'll be the first to say, maybe it is true, but I just don't believe anything arbitrarily. Bob Lazar. There's a lot of people that believe Bob Lazar's story. I'm not sitting here saying his story is not legitimate. I simply am saying I need more information to back the story up than what has been made available thus far.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the whole point of having collaboration and different similarities and cases that line up as you have with your research that you've done.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jesse, to that point, you know, one could argue, looking at the historical cases, well, you know, Marler says this about Fouché and Lazar, yet he seems to put import into these early reports. The difference is there's no detailed conspiratorial narrative involving the government and involving radical technologies, et cetera. These are simply reports by average citizens or military pilots, as I alluded to with the Albany, Georgia case, where they're simply saying, I saw something, I don't know what it was. But the distinction is, what I'm looking at are patterns in the data. When you have, from, again, the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, multiple people all over the country, all over the world, describing similar things, and I might add, at a time when triangles weren't in vogue, if I can use that term. Most people back then were reporting flying saucers.
Yes.
If you were going to lie or concoct or orchestrate a hoax regarding UFO sighting, you would think that you would shape it along a narrative that you would think UFO believers or investigators at the time would accept. Namely, I saw a 30-foot shiny silvery aluminum type disc with a little dome on top.
Right.
But in rare cases, again, that was the predominance of reports back then. But in rare cases, we do have this undercurrent of consistent reports of triangular UFOs that mirror reports that we have today, not only in shape with flight characteristics and lighting aspects. So we have all of these characteristics that are being described by different people at a time when we didn't have the internet, where you just couldn't, with about six clicks of your mouse, see what other people are reporting and then say, oh yeah, I saw that too.
Right.
So I think it's important when we look at these contemporaneous reports from the 60s, 70s, or 50s, 60s, and 70s, sorry, and look at that in the context of what's also being reported today. So we're not relying on one person's testimony. These are disparate reports spread out over decades, but also spread out worldwide, yet they're all describing very similar things.
Yeah, and that's why I try to tell everybody to report your sighting, because even if you don't think it matters, in the long term, it can with different similarities, and it can corroborate other stories and help them.
I echo your statement completely, Jesse. I state that these cases, these reports are data points.
Yes.
The more data points we have, again, the more we might be able to discern patterns or correlations in the data. But to your point, despite all these case files that are sitting here next to me that I was referencing earlier, despite all the case files that MUFON has, despite the military cases that we're aware of through Project Blue Book or the British MOD, they're still table scraps compared to the overall UFO sightings that have occurred. As we know, you know, 1 out of 10 people typically will actually formally report a UFO sighting. So
yes,
right out of the gate, we're already dealing with a small percentage of the overall data. And so, you know, but Jesse, yourself, myself, other investigators, researchers, we can only work with what we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's take advantage of what we have and try to do it to the fullest so we can get the best data out of it. So then other people have those data points to go ahead and look back at. So absolutely, I totally agree. I want to go ahead and take our break real quick. When we come back, we can dive a little deeper into the conversation. So hang on to them seatbelts. We'll be right back. Are you a normal listener to the show week in and week out and want to support what we do here? There are now two different ways that you can do so. We have a new merchandise store that you can check out on storefrontier.com/UFO Encounters Worldwide, where you can find a plethora of merchandise for UFO Encounters Worldwide, including shirts, cozies, masks, long sleeve t-shirts, sweatpants, and more. If you can't do it that way, you can also donate to our PayPal and make a donation. Either way, you'll get a shout out on the show and a place on the website in our sponsor section. Thanks for tuning in and being a supporter of the show. All Things UFO Facebook group is now the official sponsor of UFO Encounters Worldwide. It's the place where I go to get my information. They have the latest UFO news with the best topics and ran by amazing people. You go there and it's a group environment where you can share your stories with other people and get answers to the questions you need. Check them out today. That's All Things UFO Facebook group. I go there and you should too.
UFO Encounters Worldwide wants to hear from you. Have an experience or a sighting you want to share? Contact your host, Jesse Peake, at UFOEncountersWorldwide@gmail.com today.
Gypsy Days, the new clothing line specializing in custom design with you in mind, so you can be groovy and carefree while at the same time looking out of this world. Handmade to fit your every need with the best indeed. Gypsy Days Clothing, coming soon. Hey, did you know UFO Encounters Worldwide has an official website for the podcast? That's right. You can go to ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com today and check out all of the cool content we have on the UFO phenomenon. You can get all of the content and information for each episode on the website. Plus, you can follow my travels and see some of my work. There's even new weekly updates on the UFO phenomenon with megalithic structures and different places from around the world with UFO sightings. That's UFOEncountersWorldwide.wordpress.com. Check it out today. All right, welcome back to the second half of episode 42 with our special guest, David Marler, UFO historian, investigator, researcher, and author. So you do know that I'm a field investigator in Pennsylvania, and mm-hmm. I was wondering if you had any big cases that have happened in Pennsylvania that you have been doing research on.
Well, in doing that comprehensive research on the historical triangles and the NICAP case files, I mentioned the one from Pleasantville, Pennsylvania. It was actually, I checked my notes during the break, it was November 10th, 1964. But even before that, Jesse, I come across a number of triangular UFO reports in the United States, but more specifically in Pennsylvania. Hazleton, Pennsylvania, November 12th, 1957. I have an original newspaper, the Plain Speaker from Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and it had an article, and it goes into great detail describing this UFO. But the headline on the article was reports citing, quote, flying triangle, unquote, over city. So for people that say these triangles didn't exist, you know, here's another Pennsylvania case for you, describing in 1957, a flying triangle. They described it being silent with bright lights at each point of the triangle. You know, again, very reminiscent of modern day reports.
Right.
And there's just been a number of them. And again, it's not just, you know, the cases here in the United States, but when you look at these cases worldwide, the UK had, at the top of my new lecture I'm putting together, I talk about all the different names that these triangles have had over the years and in different areas. Back in the 1960s, the UK UFO researchers and even witnesses were calling flying triangles silent Vulcans, because back then they had the Vulcan bomber,
yes,
which has a triangular shape to it. But the distinction was, no surprise for those that are familiar with these triangle reports, the triangles that they were seeing had no sound. So the closest analogy that they could use was calling it a silent Vulcan. So, and then it, ironically enough, years later in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, there was another wave of triangular UFOs. And there was, in the newspapers at the time, it's probably the most obnoxious term you could use. They were calling it the Dudley Dorito.
Oh my
because
God.
It was like a Dorito snack chip.
The 3D Doritos.
So, but no matter what you call them, again, you just have this consistent reporting of these objects. And some of these can be very concerning. I had the opportunity to do an episode of Unidentified for the History Channel with Chris Mellon, and Chris was here. And Chris has a personal interest in these triangular UFOs. He and I had conversed about a year or two before that show ever came into existence. And he expressed his interest in my research. He read my book. He was a big fan of my research. And he and I had some interesting conversations. But one that I stumbled across doing my historical research, which I sent to him because I knew it would be of interest, was one from 1965, a year after the Pleasantville, Pennsylvania case I told you about. This was over the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard in Washington State. And I found a newspaper article. Again, it's great to see these vintage newspaper articles with these titles.
Yes.
The title of the article was Triangular Soundless Craft Seen. And it talks about a boilermaker that was working at the shipyard who at night saw the silent, large, triangular platform moving over the ships in the shipyard. And the lights, the street lights and the lights from the ships was reflecting off the underside of this object. What's interesting, I started doing a little bit of additional research on this. And it was interesting to note that in 1965, that same year, it was the first year that the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard started repairing and retrofitting nuclear powered naval vessels.
Wow. Okay.
So I phrase it as a question. I don't know, obviously. Is there another correlation between UFOs and nuclear, whether it's nuclear vessels, weapons, storage right. facilities? But I found that to be an interesting little correlation that same year, that's when they first started working on nuclear naval vessels.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's extremely interesting because Robert Salas just had his national press club about the UFOs over nuclear weapon bases. So
Exactly. I've actually never met Robert Salas, but we're both, I'm confirmed, I think he's tentative, but we're going to be speaking at the 75th anniversary of Roswell in July this year. So I'm really hoping I have the opportunity to meet with him. I think he's one of the more credible advocates for the subject matter, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what he's doing. I love how he's bringing everybody together again to bring this information forward on a public scale too. The best that he possibly can, and people are supporting him, which is great. And I love the support, the collaboration in the field. It's what we need.
Well, and it's interesting because there's a little bit of a corollary between what I'm doing and what he's doing, because again, I can sit here and talk about one UFO case and okay, that's great. It might be of interest. It might be a really good case. And likewise, Robert Salas might do the same thing, but what we're showing are consistent patterns in the data. You know, Robert Salas isn't talking about one incident involving nuclear weapons. To your point, he's gathered all of these launch operators and all of these military patrolmen together to talk about a series of sightings. And, you know, I always say, Jesse, no one UFO case exists in a vacuum. Once, as a MUFON investigator or an independent investigator, you go out and investigate a case to the best of your ability, that's great. But that's only the first step. I always say the next step is to ask yourself, how does this case or does this case fit in with the other data that we have available? And so, again, looking for those patterns in the data. In absence of physical evidence, I always say that's the best quote-unquote evidence that we have showing the reality of the subject matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's part of our job, what I'm doing and other people are doing, yourself, making sure we have this information for the younger generation coming up so they can continue this work in the future, you know?
I completely agree. And again, that's why I've got this arrangement with University of New Mexico. I approached them to see if they would like to preserve this material as history, because I've said in many lectures, and in fact, I lectured at the university on the UFO subject, and I preface by stating, because admittedly, we have different people from all walks of life, different knowledge base regarding the subject or complete lack thereof. And so I always try to do some level setting for the public audiences, not so much the UFO conferences, because these are people already invested in the subject or have a keen interest, but for community groups, school groups, I always say, you know, whether you relegate the UFO subject to fact, fiction, or folklore, we can all agree and find some common ground that it is part of our culture, and therefore it's part of our history. And that's how I pitched the material to the University of New Mexico, and they couldn't argue with that, of course. And they said, it's not only part of American history and global history, it's part of New Mexico history with all of the interesting UFO sightings and cases we've had here. And so they are readily accepting this material. And again, as I alluded to during the first half of the show, that is one of the reasons Philip Mantle is sending all his files out here, is so that they will be preserved and will be accessible for future generations, to your point.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. And that actually rings a bell in my area, because my podcast is ranked under indie science fiction. And, you know, everyone's like, are you serious? Can you believe this? And then I'm the same way. I'm like, yeah, this is how they rank it. You know, even though I'm sitting here talking with real people about real things, you know, and facts right. That have happened, this is real history and it should be nonfiction, you know?
No, I completely agree. In fact, I was in, I believe it was a Barnes & Noble recently, which I usually don't frequent. I, you know, they don't have anything that I'm interested in for the most part. But I went in and I was shocked and surprised. When I was growing up in the 70s and even in the 80s, usually UFO books were under New Age or metaphysical or paranormal. And I went in recently, and I believe the term, don't quote me on this, but I believe it was UFO books were now under the heading self-exploration.
Really?
And I thought that was such an odd category to put UFOs under, self-exploration.
Yeah, that is. That is really weird. They do need to fix the naming and how they file this stuff, because it's all over the place. And like you said, it's an important subject. So they need to put more valid, however you would say it, more backing behind it to make this a real focused subject.
Well, especially now, you know, with the Pentagon report coming out and basically the government stating that the phenomenon is real, whatever it is. To your point, I mean, we're not talking abstract, ethereal ideas or concepts. You know, for myself, that's been doing this for decades now, I never thought we would see a moment when UFOs has the official seal of approval. In other words, they're acknowledging the phenomenon, even though they're not sharing much detail. In fact, just the other day, I don't know if you've had a chance to see this or your audience, but I had a chance to see the classified but redacted Pentagon UAP report that John Greenwald posted. It's got a lot of black.
Yes, I did see that.
On the pages. A lot of black. But one of the things that caught my attention, and in fact, I emailed Chris Mellon and kind of jokingly said, Chris, I wish I knew what was behind all this black, was page 13 in the report. They have a section, a very large section, completely blacked out, but the header is common shapes. And then the second one, which is also blacked out under that, less common or irregular shapes. If I was a betting man, Jesse, and I'm not, if I was a betting man, I bet triangles is one of the shapes listed under common shapes reported.
Absolutely, and I take that bet in a heartbeat. And that's what I wanted to ask you about that. You know, it's been 75 plus years since Roswell. What do you think is behind this information coming out now with the June 25th report and, you know, Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon doing what they're doing, you know?
It's a great question. And I feel that a lot of UFO researchers and a lot of journalists kind of miss the big question. And that's what you just touched on. They're describing what happened and how it happened and who said what. And, oh, here's the DOD videos. To me, the fundamental question is, why now?
Exactly.
That therein lies the true mystery beyond the UAP subject, the UFO subject. Why now are they doing a complete 180 after decades long of denial, ridicule, misinformation, disinformation? And I wrote in my book, I believe, back in 2013, that I don't believe any government of the world, because it's a worldwide, you know, phenomenon, obviously. I'm not going to point fingers just at the United States government or military, and I'm not doing it in a disparaging way.
Absolutely.
But why were they covering this up for decades only now to do an about face? I've always said, and I've always believed, that no government is going to willingly acknowledge the subject unless it's in their best interest. Now, let me expound on that, because your audience is probably scratching their head like, what's he talking about?
Please do.
I think, and again, I for people that know me, friends and colleagues, I don't arbitrarily just throw things out there. It's after a lot of rumination, a lot of thought. I think the secret or a glimmer into why they've done this about face is in the 2019 Navy spokesman statement. And again, this is where I think some journalists missed out in really seizing on the right quote. They stated that, you know, due to the DOD videos, due to the acknowledgement of this phenomenon, that the Navy is going to formulate official policy and procedures for naval personnel to report UAPs. Okay, that was what most of them seized upon. The second statement, though, by the Navy spokesman is what caught my attention. It stated the rationale for doing so is due to the increased frequency of UAP sightings in and around sensitive military installations and military operations areas. I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember the exact words, but that was the gist of it. So what they said is they're seeing an increase. If they're seeing an increase, and if they see that it is continuing to increase, I believe, and again, it's speculation on my part, I'm willing to concede that, but if they're seeing a growing trend of UFOs or UAPs being reported near military areas, and if that trend continues in that positive linear trend, it's going to get to the point where they cannot deny, they cannot cover up, they cannot withhold this information if they feel that this trajectory is going to continue. So I feel that this was motivated by the fact that they see this increase. They don't think it's going to diminish, again, based on whatever information that's at their disposal. And to use the old government term, they don't want the tail wagging the dog. In other words, if this continues, covering this up is going to be untenable. Therefore, we need to start gradually letting people know this is real. You know, try not to cause a panic in the process, but basically get the public acclimated and prepared.
Now, do you think there will be any backlash for that because they have covered it up for so long?
I think there can be. And I think you've seen a guarded approach towards this when you look at the UAP report. If you, as I stated many times, if you knew nothing about the UFO subject, if literally you were existing on an island somewhere that didn't have any communication with the outside world, if you read that report, you would assume, based on what's contained therein, that this UFO subject all started in 2004.
Right.
They made a conscious effort not to touch on the UFO history, in my opinion. And the reason, one of the reasons for that is exactly to your point, Jesse, to your question. If they start going into the history, they have to acknowledge the mishandling, if I can use that term, of the UFO subject for decades.
Yeah. And I mean, people's lives ruined, families, everything.
Absolutely. So I think they made a conscious effort. We're not going to go there. In other words, keep that door closed. Don't open Pandora's box.
Right.
And so I think they just decided to stick with these military reports. And again, it was focused on military encounters. But as we know, both within Blue Book and other government records, there's ample historical military reports, if that's all they want to focus on, that they could have looked at. Now, I believe there's been some vague references that they might look at some of the historical data. But it's interesting because not only with the government are you seeing this avoidance of going into the UFO history, you're seeing it with people like Dr. Avi Loeb and the Galileo Project and others that say, well, we're going to investigate the subject, but we're only going to look at things occurring now moving forward. It's almost like there's a conscious attempt to divorce themselves from the UFO history. And for different reasons, I think with Dr. Avi Loeb and the academics, they don't want to be associated with UFOs. As I like to say, they're not UFO researchers, they're UAP scientists. So they're trying to make a clear delineation between the UFO believers, the UFO researchers of yesteryear, and trying to say we're something separate and distinct and better than that. So, you know, and they're doing it for various reasons, I think, you know, to cover their academic credentials, you know, to ensure that they don't go too far afield from academia. I think it's great that they're doing this. And again, I welcome the efforts of Dr. Avi Loeb, the Galileo Project, and other mainstream scientists that are now starting to look at the subject. I don't want to have people think that I'm disparaging that. I encourage it. The more brains and sets of eyes we have looking at the data, so much the better. I just think that bodes well for the future. But because of this, though, Jesse, because of institutions, scientists, and the government report not touching on the history, I truly feel that for myself and the likes of Barry Greenwood, Jan Aldridge, Mike Swords, Mark Rodiger, other historical researchers that are out there, I truly feel it's incumbent upon us to present that valid historical argument. If they're not going to do it, we have the data. And we should be the ones to bring this to the forefront and enter that into the discussion because of some of the cases that I was alluding to earlier, some of these cases that people have never even heard of before. And I think it's important, especially this year, 2022, Jesse, the 75th anniversary of the modern age of UFOs. 75 years ago, this June, Kenneth Arnold had his sighting and the term flying saucer was coined out of that. So we have 7.5 decades worth of historical UFO data in the form of civilian reports, military reports worldwide. Why should we not tap into that? And I use the analogy for researchers and scientists to say, we're not going to look at the history. We're only going to look at things moving forward. To me, that's very short-sighted. That's the equivalent of me as, say, a Pennsylvania police investigator that moves to Oregon. And I go into the briefing room and the police officers there are telling me we've had a rash of burglaries, and they begin to tell me about the burglaries that occurred. And I sit back and say, no, I don't want to know about anything that happened in the past. I only want to investigate burglaries that are occurring today moving forward.
Right.
It's like using that analogy, but we can tell you their method of entry. We can tell you the areas they're targeting. We can tell you what they're stealing. We can tell you where we think they're fencing the material and things that they've stolen.
Yeah. And I think
why wouldn't I, as an investigator, want to know that as I continue to look at these burglaries? And whether it's burglaries or UFOs, the argument I would say is still the same. Why would we not want to look at this data?
Exactly. And I think if we know about the data and we don't talk about the data, we're kind of being just as wrong as they were by covering it up.
I completely agree. Couldn't agree with you more, Jesse.
Yeah. So I know there's a lot of different views in ufology today, and there's a lot of different things going on. And I believe disclosure is a process. It's not any just particular one thing. where should individuals that are getting into ufology or have been in ufology, what do you think that their steps should be and their focus should be to help bring disclosure forward?
Wow, that's such a hard question to answer. There's so many different avenues that people can pursue. Related to that, I'll come back to that, but related to that, one of the big questions I have people ask me, I've had people that have been visiting my research room here to look at materials because they've just only recently, in the last few years, since the New York Times article broke, and all the subsequent, you know, DoD videos and discussion.
Yep.
There's a whole new generation, as you and your audience know, that are now for the first time looking at the subject matter. And related to that, one of the questions I often have them ask me is, where do I start? Where do I find credible UFO information?
Yes.
Because I really feel sorry for people coming into it today because,
oh my God.
You know, there's crazy people in the field, there's con artists, there's people just looking to make a buck. But mixed in with that, you have sane, credible, objective, serious researchers and investigators. And so it is really hard to separate that. The one thing I try to caution people against as they're getting into it is try to avoid getting sucked into the YouTube UFO footage phenomenon. It's great entertainment, but it's not research because most of these videos, you get the emotional high, like, ooh, that's exciting, or wow, that's intriguing. But more often than not, or almost 100% of the time, you never can track these videos down to the source. And we have to keep in mind, there are active groups that are posting intentionally hoaxed UFO videos online just to get clicks.
Yeah, so, I'm seeing a lot of that.
So, you know, I have a little cartoon that I have where it's there's a Simpsons character sitting at a computer. He says, I am a researcher, and he spells it R-E-S-U-R-C-H-E-R. And he's typing into a computer into YouTube, and it's basically, show me what I already believe. And so, you know, but back to your point, you know, there's so many different aspects. I mean, obviously, there's people that are focused on the political lobbying. For disclosure, to your point, writing your congressman and appealing to political individuals. There's people like John Greenwald that, you know, are doing the FOIA request to try to at least pry some of these government documents out of declassification and make them accessible to the public. MUFON, I would argue MUFON is probably one of the best avenues to pursue if they want to learn how to investigate, if they want to learn to be able to network with other investigators, not just in your state, in the country, but worldwide. It's a great springboard to, you know, start your journey into UFO research and UFO investigation. And then, you know, many people branch off on their own just to pursue their own personal interests, which I certainly encourage. There's the historical avenues as well. And so, you know, I think there's multiple approaches to trying to, you know, move towards, you know, disclosure or a greater awareness with regard to the subject. The one thing I caution, and I often say, it doesn't matter what you study. And I mentioned this at the University of New Mexico to a bunch of academics that were there, and they agreed that it doesn't matter the subject matter that you study, rather your methodology that you employ in studying the subject matter.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Because
if you go in with a belief system that I already believe X, Y, Z about the UFO subject,
right?
Well, then you're already skewed. You're not a true objective researcher. I try to look at myself as an attorney building a case. You know, looking at the information as if I was going to present it in a court of law. And so, with that, you know, I try to show patterns in the data, cite my resources so people can go and look at the information themselves, and try to eliminate, as MUFON investigators do, you first try to eliminate all the knowns. And once you eliminate all the knowns and you're still left with this case, you're dealing with a genuine unknown.
Absolutely. And I try to tell people that all the time, is that you have to stay open-minded in the field, because if you go in with the aspect of you knowing something, that's gonna implement on how you come out with the outcome of the case.
Absolutely, and you know, quite often we cite the Air Force and some of the flippant explanations they've had over the decades when they were handling the UFO subject, and people laugh when they hear, "Well, they said it was Venus, it was weather balloons, it was a meteor." Well, I'm here to tell you, having gone through 1947 and 1977, you know, all of the 30 years of case files, a large percentage of those were meteors.
Yep,
a large percentage of those were balloons, meteorological or otherwise. There's a one of the most well-publicized triangle reports was over Madrid, Spain in 1968. And I talk about this in my new lecture this year. But what I found was that the imagery, there was a photograph taken, the object was higher than jets could attain. And all of these people were looking, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of witnesses saw this, not just one day, but on two separate days. And they described it as a triangle, at least in the initial reports. Some of the later reports described it as like an inverted pyramid. And there was a photograph taken that hit the news wires worldwide. And it showed this triangular object, but it was bright and reflective in nature. And lo and behold, later, days and weeks later, the Spanish Meteorological Association issued a statement that it was, in fact, a French meteorological balloon. And if you look at a French meteorological balloon, directly underneath, as it's flying overhead, it takes on the exact same appearance. It didn't have any lighting characteristics. It didn't have any exotic flight characteristics. And I mention that because I have the original letter to NICAP from the director of the Madrid Meteorological Association, where they have the official explanation that that's what it was. So just one example that, you know, there are balloons that are misidentified. There are meteor sightings that trigger UFO sightings. So
yes,
I don't use it as a generic explanation as the Air Force. When we're looking at these UFO reports, and there's a lot of noise.
Yes, there is. And I try to tell people that a lot of it can be naturally explained, and you have to do your due diligence and make sure you research and educate yourself. And then you can do the proper investigation and get the good outcome.
Absolutely.
But we have,
again, getting back to methodology.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We have about a minute left. Do you want to tell everybody where they could follow you and get your book at?
Yeah, Jesse, thank you. My website is www.davidmarler, M-A-R-L-E-R, UFO.com. I do have some postings on there. I have some write-ups on some historical cases. I also have, if anyone's interested, some audio clips, some audio recordings from that collection I was telling you about from the 50s and the 60s. So you'll hear some vintage audio recordings under the audio archive tab. And that's just a very small percentage of the overall recordings that I now have. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, I received another 200 audio tapes from Rod. So I'm currently working on those as well as working on my presentation. But yes, there's a link there to order my book. And, you know, if anybody's interested in just looking at some of the other videos and interviews I've done for local media, et cetera, it's on there. But, you know, just use it as a vehicle to reach out to people.
All right, great. Yeah. And I put everything in the description of the episode so everybody can get that information there. And they can also email me if they need other information about you. I'll happily give it out. And I want to thank you, David, for coming on today. It's been a pleasure. I've learned so much, and I thank you.
Well, thank you, Jesse. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation. It's probably the fastest hour I've ever had.
It did. It flew by. Absolutely flies by when you're enjoying it and getting good information like that. But thank you again for coming on today, and I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We will be back next week with our once-a-month MUFON Top Cases of the Month. So until then, everybody, keep your eyes in the sky. Well, that's another episode of UFO Encounters Worldwide with our special guest, David Marler. I learned so much today about triangular craft that I've never even known about before. And some of the stuff that he's researched and perspectives that he has are absolutely amazing. And I definitely recommend anybody to go check out his book on the triangular craft. It's an amazing review and people are loving it. Next week, we are going to have our normal once a month MUFON Journal Top Cases. And that should be a really good episode with a lot of information. Remember to get your pen and paper or take down your case number so you can research it later on. And remember that this episode is sponsored by All Things UFO Facebook group and Gypsy Days clothing line. Also, go over and check out our new merchandise store. you can go to storefrontier.com/UFO encounters worldwide, and you can get a plethora of merchandise for the podcast. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in this week. And until next time, keep your eyes in the sky. Yeah.